Do you ever want to watch a bad movie?
Do you ever hate yourself so much that you want to put on a movie that makes you want to rip out your own eyeballs?
Welcome to the worst movies ever.
Probably.
My name is Dottie James, and I am so scared of horror films.
And I'm Patty Walters, and I love watching horror films.
So we decided to compromise, and this Halloween we decided to watch terrible horror films and talk about them on this podcast for you guys.
And it's been a really great time. It's been a lot of fun watching the 8 or 9 worst horror films ever made in the past 100 years of cinema. We've learned a lot. We've laughed a lot. We've cried possibly more than we've laughed, but it's left us with memories, fond or otherwise. But before we get into the podcast, there are 3 things that I say at the beginning of every podcast. And the first is that today is Halloween, and it would be a great idea if you stayed inside and looked after yourself as well as everybody else. Secondly, November 3rd is a very, very important election. And if you are a citizen of the United States, please vote. You must vote like I have done. It is very important. And thirdly, in this podcast, we spoil every moment of the films we talk about. And today, we are talking about the best worst movie
to roll to. This is a different sort of bad film.
Yes.
Like, I have not properly enjoyed a single one of these films.
Yeah.
And I really enjoy this one.
You loved this.
Yeah, I think it's great.
And I love this film.
Yeah, I have a lot of nice things to say about this film. We watched the documentary before we watched the film today.
That's correct.
And so that was really nice. It was really nice to hear just how this silly film has brought so much joy to the actors who were in it.
Yeah.
Just normal people who didn't realize that this was going to get a following in any way. And
it was
really sweet to hear their stories.
So before we get started, Troll 2, released in 1990, made on a budget of an estimation of about $200,000. Directed by Claudio Fragasso and written by Rossella Drudi, the two of whom are married to each other. It was filmed in rural Utah, and I believe all the actors were living in Utah at the time of filming this. And from what I remember reading is that all the actors playing the lead roles in this film auditioned expecting to be cast as extras, and they were they were cast as the leads, and that's how this film kind of came to be. So our film begins, and we see a guy walking through the woods, and whatever the reason, he looks like Buddy the Elf with a less festive, more autumnal rebrand. Like if Buddy the Elf drank pumpkin spice lattes or something.
The beginning of this film is essentially the beginning of The Princess Bride.
Yes.
The Princess Bride came out first,
surely. It did come out first.
Yes.
That is correct.
So copying, but whatever. With a grandpa reading to his grandchild. That's the vibe. If you're picturing anything, picture that.
So basically, the guy walking through the woods, his name is Peter, but Peter is merely a character in a book that Grandpa Seth is reading to our young protagonist, Joshua Waits, played by Michael Paul Stevenson. And he is tucked under the covers and seriously stressed out by tonight's bedtime story. Grandpa Seth continues to read, and these are the words he reads at the beginning of the film. Peter was a courageous boy, but that dawn, he could feel fear stick to his skin like dew on leaves. The fog was thick enough to make him lose his way home. Then he began to hear strange noises coming from the depths of the forest. He noticed a presence, small shadows that seemed to giggle as they followed in his footsteps. Then Joshua chimes in. He goes, "Who were they, Grandpa?" "Cruel, deformed forest dwellers, haughty creatures, spiteful and impudent. They are the vengeful and evil goblins, the little people of the night."
Yep.
Right. So this is your first clue into the fact that Troll 2 has nothing to do with trolls at all.
This
is a film about goblins. And the film was titled Goblin for I don't know how far into the pre-production process. But later, it was somebody's bright idea to capitalize off of a film called Troll.
Yep.
That already existed and try to piggyback off of that franchise.
Yeah.
That's basically what happened. So like we said, this film is about goblins. There's not a single fucking troll that is ever going to be mentioned in this film. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's a weird idea, right? Like,
yeah.
I get it. You're trying to capitalize on an already existing fandom or whatever. But so if you're going to do that,
I think a lot of horror films do that, though.
Yeah, but it's just so easy to change your goblins into trolls.
Not if you've already filmed half of the film and only came up with this brilliant idea.
Right, like, maybe, yeah.
Then.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know at what point they bailed on that idea. But I would argue that if it came after they filmed and called their town Nilbog, it's a little too late. And you need to just commit to goblin the
think?
Film at this point. So the goblins. I really tried to find words that would describe these guys, but I think you're just gonna have to Google it. There are no words that I can string together that can describe how cheap and ineffective these costumes are. They are not excellent. That's my review.
No, they're not excellent. They sort of look like potato skins that have been like petrified or something.
Yeah, right. The masks are cheap. They kind of have gray hair glued all over them in various places. And they're wearing burlap sacks and the gloves are just sort of taped on. And as we learned from the documentary, this was a problem, is that the hands did not
would,
reach
like,
all
off
the
them,
way
yeah.
to the bottom of where the fingers of the gloves end. So
yes.
Not excellent. So we've established that they're goblins. We've established how they look. And this is what the storybook says. To make a long story short, Peter started to run and run and run. And Peter runs through the opening credits. And the score is just super 80s. It's like a Phil Collins song on steroids. Just like arpeggiators and MIDI trumpets and gnarly guitar bends. Shit just rocks. It's a good time. But is a storybook allowed to say, to make a long story short, Peter started to run? It's like, I don't think you're allowed to do that. You are the story. You're not allowed to make a long story short. You are a long story. Be a long story. The storybook character gets chased by goblins all through the opening credits until he trips and somersaults his way straight into Concussionsville, population Peter. When he wakes up, a beautiful girl is kneeling before him, fake freckles across her face, smiling and holding what looks like a bowl of green pudding.
It's like custard. He's like staring at this bowl of pudding, mm-hmm. staring at her. Someone had literally just taken a brown eyeliner pencil and just like dotted it around her face.
Yeah.
And
it looks
just
like,
left it.
It looks like it's done in like brown Sharpie. But she's holding a bowl of like green pudding. It's like melted pistachio ice cream.
It's custard.
Yeah, probably. And Peter presses his lips to the bowl and he eats or drinks from the bowl of light green goo, staring deeply into the girl's eyes until his expression changes from ecstasy to agony, and a river of dark green corn syrup begins to cascade down his face. And in the words of Grandpa Seth, he began sweating chlorophyll green. The girl has now vanished, and a gang of goblins stand where she stood, menacing and hungry, because Peter is now half man, half plant, the goblin's favorite food.
So the premise of the goblins is that they are vegetarians, yes?
Yes? Well,
they're
yeah,
vegetarians because they turn people into vegetables
see,
and then eat
yeah,
them.
Yeah, I would argue someone who eats something that is half person is not a vegetarian, but
yes,
that is...
But that's what the
that's
creators
this film's
of
logic,
the film
and it's
said,
fine,
yeah.
I guess. We'll just roll with it. So the goblins begin to eat Peter, at which point a hand reaches for a light switch. It's Joshua's mom, wondering what he's still doing awake. He explains that Grandpa Seth was reading him a sto- he stops himself, and the camera zooms out to reveal that the rocking chair is empty, albeit still rocking back and forth, but whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I don't know what that means. Is that happening in the room? Is like,
yeah, we know it really happens because Grandpa Seth like saves the day a few times.
But yeah, so Joshua's mom is seeing like a moving rocking chair and she's just cool with this shit. I don't know. So Joshua's mom reminds him that Grandpa Seth has been gone for over 6 months and that goblins don't exist. And she says goodnight twice. And then she turns out the lights.
She also reminds him that Grandpa Seth has been gone for 6 months and it made his dad sad and his sister and her, quote, his daughter.
Yes.
Sad.
So we cut to Joshua's big sister, Holly, who's ripping a midnight workout, bench pressing barbells with her headphones on, rocking some more mental 80s like prog pop or whatever this shit is. So meanwhile, mom and dad, aka Diana and Michael Waits, are downstairs and getting organized for their upcoming house exchange adventure tomorrow morning, a month-long trip to the small town of Nilbog, a wonderful half-empty town, as it's later described, where they'll be living in a local family's house, and the same family will be staying here.
That's fun.
It is fun. And there's nothing else kind of notable about this apart from where just sort of like without any sort of prompting, Diana Waits just kind of asks her husband, Michael, who are the goblins? And her poor husband has to just respond, the goblins. As you would, I guess. It's fucked.
Oh, yeah.
So later the same night, Joshua can't sleep and he hears something outside. Reaching for a flashlight on his bedside table, he sneaks out of his bed, tiptoes across the room, rips back the blinds to reveal the scariest monster of all, a teenage boy. This specific teenage boy is Elliot Cooper, Holly's boyfriend, and he's joined by his goofy friends, Drew, Brent, and Arnold, who are stabilizing a tall ladder down on the ground. Elliot climbs back up the ladder, this time into Holly's bedroom, and surprises her in the middle of her midnight workout. She is indeed surprised. Pissed, actually. So pissed.
Well, yeah, because the way he surprises her, he stands over her. His face just kind of comes into frame and you see what she sees, which is just a face hanging over you as you're working out in your bedroom. Of course, she's going to beat him up.
She punches Elliot in the balls, at which point she says, if my father discovers you here, he'd cut off your little nuts and eat them. He can't stand you. But she likes Elliot, and the only thing this poor girl wants is to spend time with her boyfriend without his ridiculous friends around. So she invites him, and only him, on their month-long family getaway to Nilbog, and he promises to be there tomorrow morning, alone. A promise that he breaks because we immediately cut to Holly in the backseat of the family station wagon, absolutely fucking miserable.
She's like, do you want to come on our family vacation? And he's like, yeah, of course I do. She's like, alone? And then he's just like, but what about the boys?
Yeah, so
he's alone, like, for a second. Yeah. Not even alone. Go and be with your girlfriend, who you presumably want to hang out with.
Yeah,
I don't blame her for not wanting to hang around with your friends all the time. Because this man, as we learn, is unreasonably attached to these two boys.
They are inseparable. This boy is incapable of being apart from these people for a single moment.
It's very bizarre, but I do love them all as a ragtag group of characters.
Holly is inconsolable in the backseat of the station wagon. She gets in a huge argument with her father about how Elliot loves her and wanted to come and isn't a good for nothing like her dad says. But dad delayed their departure by 90 minutes for this motherfucker. So I'm kind of on dad's side here, if I'm honest. That's a generous amount of time.
It's over an
hour. To donate to this dude and he still doesn't show. Mom defuses the fight and orders Joshua to sing that song she likes so much.
It's so abrupt. They're having this argument. First of all, mum never faces forward in the car. That's just not a thing that happens in this film. She is constantly like an eagle watching her two children. The girl and the dad are having this argument and she just suddenly goes like, we're not going to talk about this. Joshua, sing that song I like.
Yeah. And he goes, I don't feel like singing. Just sing.
He doesn't have a choice. Yeah. So then he has to start this like half-hearted row, row, row your boat. She doesn't know the name of row, row, row your boat.
She's unfamiliar with the title. She doesn't hazard a guess.
Sing that song.
She's like, what's that song I like so much? Row, row, row your boat. So at which point the most chaotic and stressful rendition of row, row, row your boat begins. And the family continue their drive through the Rocky Mountains of Utah. But like they're doing it in canon. It's just loud and it's like not chaos. Fun. Nobody's enjoying it because mom's just doing it to diffuse the tension. It's not
terrible
great.
Parenting skills.
But the Waits family aren't the only ones heading to Nobog. Behind the steering wheel of a Winnebago is world's worst boyfriend, Elliot Cooper, driving himself and his uninvited
and
boys. to the Waits family holiday.
I love this subplot. It's amazing.
Elliot has not only failed his girlfriend, but he's lied to his three best friends, telling them that Nobog is full of beautiful girls, pretty and unattached. Also, the four friends are wearing different colored plain shirts. So Elliot's in red, Drew's in yellow, Brent's green, and Arnold's blue. It's a weird choice, and they look like the fucking Wiggles. Like,
I love it.
Meanwhile, up ahead in the family van, Joshua wakes up from a nap, dripping with sweat. He asks his dad to pull over so he can be sick, but something's wrong. His family's acting strange, intentionally this time.
They're trying to act strange. This is the bit I love. I love these shots.
Yeah.
It's so Roald Dahl. It's shot from like underneath the characters with like scary lighting.
Spooky, like,
so,
like the flashlight uplighting, like telling a scary story.
It's so stylized. I love it. And they're super close to the camera and they're like, what's the matter, Josh? And it's, oh, I love it. It's great.
So they're acting strange and they want him to be sick. He ate too much, stuffed himself like a pig, and now they can eat him. Joshua looks down at his hands. Branches are growing out of his fingertips. Chlorophyll green sweat is pouring down his face. Something spiky stabs its way out through the front of his stomach. And worst of all, his family are no longer his family at all. They are goblins. No, don't eat me, Joshua screams as he wakes up from his dream. His family ask if he's all right, and he downplays the terror from his dream. Joshua looks out the car window when he sees him standing there on the side of the highway. It's Grandpa Seth, wearing a dirty white t-shirt and khaki cap, and holding a large sign that just reads, "Stop them," in all caps,
so
exclamation point.
Grandpa Seth has the same energy as Santa Claus.
Yeah, big time.
Instead of him being a ghost, it's like, oh, here's Santa to come and save the day, rather than here's your dead grandfather trying to stop you from dying.
So Joshua does stop them. He urgently tells his family he needs to throw up, and they pull over to the side of the road. Joshua runs towards Grandpa Seth. His grandpa warns him that he must convince his family to return home. Nilbog even gives him the creeps, whatever that's supposed to imply about this man. It's like, how creepy is this guy that he's like, this even gives me the creeps, and I'm a fucking weirdo.
I think it might just mean like he's a grown-up.
Or a ghost. I don't really know.
He's a ghost. That's true. Yeah.
Well, the station wagon reverses right up to the two of them mid-conversation, and Mom demands that Joshua get back in the car and explain himself, because when Joshua turns back to face his grandpa, wearing the same dirty t-shirt and cap, we see a stranger covered in dirt and with a gruff voice asks, so how about it? You're going to give me a ride or not?
To their credit, this stranger does look sort of like the granddad. I was very impressed.
Yeah, they did okay.
With this transformation.
They did okay.
Also, you would be pretty shaken if your kid gets out of the car and just starts talking to a hitchhiker.
Yeah, just covered in dirt.
How old is Joshua? He's like...
The actor was 12 at the time.
12?
Yeah.
He looks about 9.
I know, yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know how old his character is. I don't know if
I think Joshua's about 9.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that.
So deflated and disoriented, Joshua gets back in the car, and the family drive away without acknowledging or apologizing to this man at all.
Yep.
It's just so rude, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
this
reality,
man
yeah.
didn't start a conversation with you. You started talking to this guy.
Yeah, you stopped your car
yes, pulled
next
it over.
To him and then said, nah.
You don't look at him and you don't say anything and you just leave. And I'm like, fuck y'all.
Well, actually, that's not true. Joshua had a whole conversation with him. That must have been very one-sided.
Super one-sided. So the family drive off. and it's only a moment later that Elliot and his Teletubby looking ass friends are waving at Holly from the side of the road. She waves back with an outstretched middle finger, and that's this whole scene, I guess.
Yeah, because she's found out that he brought his boys.
Brought his boys. What'd you expect?
Yeah.
This is Elliot.
It's just Elliot, and it's so weird. It's like, first of all, you invite yourself. Then you invite your three other friends.
Can you imagine if I invited you on a holiday with my family,
and you
bring your boys?
And I'm like, but can I bring the boys?
Of course you can't bring the boys.
But what about my boys? No, it's not. Yeah, it's not even like asking. It's like, but where will these three other guys sleep?
Yeah. So the Waits family arrive in the quaint town of Nilbog. They park and get their bearings in front of an empty drugstore. But when they pull away towards their new home for the month, the drugstore window fills with locals, all in trucker caps or cowboy hats, all watching the Waits family drive away. The Waits family arrive at the home of the Presents family. Their last name is Presents. And it's confusing.
They could have chosen any name in the world.
Four Nilbog locals who look about as pleasant as the plague. The family also consists of a mom, a dad, an older sister, and a younger brother. So they kind of like mirror the dynamic of the Waits family. So Michael Waits grins and extends his right arm out for a handshake. But Daddy Nilbog merely replies with a cold, "You're late." Joshua begins to gawk at each family member in front of him, specifically a small blotchy patch of skin in the shape of a clover that they all seem to share somewhere on each other's bodies.
They never explain this kind of lore.
They definitely don't.
Clovers on the human version.
They definitely don't. I don't know what the importance of a clover leaf holds in relation to a goblin. If this were a film about leprechauns, I'm here for it. I also don't know what the blotchy patch of skin implies. Is that like a weak spot in their armor? Or
no, because they never use it.
That's
what
I mean. It's just it doesn't mean anything. Why is it in this film? Why? Whose idea was it? At what point did we lose its importance?
It's a trope in like children's versus adults stories.
Sure.
Where it's like the child is the only one that can see what's going
right.
on. Like, don't you see they have these blotches?
Yeah.
I'm going to defend this film the whole time.
I'm here for it. I'm so here for it. So the matriarchs of the family, they exchange house keys, and the Presents family begin to drive away, leaving George Waits disheartened and listing off their household appliances to himself.
Microwave.
Yeah, microwave, fridge. He says bar.
We have a toilet.
Yeah. The Waits family walk inside, all of them except for Joshua, who, still looking puzzled, watches the family drive away when the young Nilbog boy throws a baseball in Joshua's direction. Joshua catches it, and he discovers green letters covering the ball, and they spell...
In, like, icing.
Yeah, it's weird, and they spell out, "Eat before we eat you." So Joshua joins his family inside. Hungry after their long drive from Wherever'sville, Utah, they search the home for a bite to eat when they find the dining room table completely covered by a home-cooked smorgasbord of disturbing green food and pitchers of red and green liquid or something.
It's their hospitality that they say so often.
Typical country hospitality.
Yep, that's
it. He loves that hard tea at the end of hospitality.
Hospitality.
The family are delighted and promptly dig in. Well, all of them except for Joshua, of course. He looks across the room and he sees his imaginary grandpa friend once again. This time on the other side of the screen door. More urgent than ever, Grandpa Seth warns Joshua that he must stop his family from eating all the nasty-ass green food.
I love this bit.
Because if they do, what happened to Peter in the story will happen to them as well.
I love this bit. I think it's magical. It's not especially well executed.
No.
But yeah, Grandpa basically tells Joshua that he has 30 seconds
yes.
to figure out what's going to stop his family from eating.
Yes.
He snaps his fingers or something and stops time.
Yes, an ability that never comes back. And
no,
would have been particularly helpful at several different moments in this film.
Absolutely.
There's like a bunch of pissed off goblins and being able to just like freeze time for 30 seconds. Yeah, we could use that right now, Grandpa. So Grandpa Seth snaps his fingers and all at once the family are frozen at the dinner table, giving Joshua...
In theory...
On
it's a lot more difficult for some reason for these actors to freeze entirely.
Yeah,
I get it. They're held in very difficult positions.
Well, yeah.
Their arms are up. Who knows how long these shots took? The shot itself is very long.
It's a very long shot. This is the thing, is Grandpa Seth allegedly gives Joshua 30 seconds. It's closer to 70.
Oh, yeah.
So Joshua has 30 seconds to stop his family from eating the food. Slowly circling the table, no sense of urgency at all. Really milking the scene for all that it's worth.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's got to think, you know?
Joshua arrives at the one empty chair. And he psychs himself up, he unzips his jeans, and he pisses all over the food.
There are many things he could have done. Many, many things. The time is frozen. He could literally just take the food out of their hands. I thought he was going to whip the table sheet off and just put the food all over the floor.
All options.
That also would have worked.
All perfectly good options.
Exactly. But as you say, no, he pees all over
it. And I'm glad he did, because it prompts the greatest line in this film. So
yeah.
I'm not mad.
Go ahead.
So Michael storms upstairs with Joshua slung over his shoulder as Diana and Holly scrape the pea food into the trash. Upstairs, the family's names are written on the doors of their corresponding bedrooms. Michael carries his son to his room at the end of the hall, and he delivers one of the film's most beloved lines of dialogue. "Do you see this writing? Do you know what it means? Hospitality. And you can't piss on hospitality. I won't allow it." Joshua is dropped onto his bed. And as his father reaches for his belt, he asks, "What are you going to do to me, Daddy?" And Daddy replies, "Tightening my belt by one loop so I don't feel hunger pains. And your sister and mother will have to do likewise."
The thing about this scene, you hear it now. When you're watching it at the time, it's not. It doesn't seem as suggestive.
Right.
I don't think, anyway, because I didn't get to watch it for the first time before I'd seen the documentary where they recreate it.
Yeah, 20 years later.
With that kid now being an adult.
32-year-old, yeah. My assumption was always going to be that he was going to hit his son with his belt. But my other favorite theory is that he is going to punish Joshua by peeing on him. So Michael berates his son some more. Joshua shamefully glances around the room, eyeing the strange goblin-themed artwork along the walls, and the scene ends. Meanwhile, Elliot and his fuckboy friends are watching a film, when Arnold, the boy in the blue shirt, in case that's symbolic or something, he excuses himself for a cigarette and a sulk, because instead of meeting beautiful women, they're just watching some weird-ass film about a golden egg and a monkey with a jetpack.
Yeah, I want to watch the film that they were watching, honestly.
So Arnold steps outside, and it's almost instantly that he sees a beautiful girl.
Where on earth does this girl come from? It's never explained.
It's never explained. So maybe Elliot isn't such a bad friend after all. He's just a terrible boyfriend. Except this girl is clearly in trouble, out of breath and running through the woods, running away from something.
She gives an okay performance.
The woman's white clothes are ripped and her face is frightened. And it's also covered in green syrup. Almond. Arnold sprints up after her, and after a short chase,
can we call him Almond from now on, please?
Yeah, fuck it, why not? Almond sprints up after her, and after a short chase through the woods, he catches her and heroically tackles her very hard into the ground.
Oh my god, this woman's face hits the dirt. I do not know how her nose wasn't broken.
Yeah, it's like some mono shit where it's like, I don't know if you could have faked how hard this woman is tackled into the grass.
She is literally just taken out by him.
Well, she's relieved to see that Almond isn't one of the monsters that made her eat the green stuff. What monsters? Those monsters. Here come the goblins. 8 or so ridiculous duct taped together goblins.
Yeah, we have the really frightening one that you and I kept seeing in every shot of the goblins.
Excellent.
The rest of them have fairly homogenized aesthetics.
Yeah.
This one is Nosferatu. That's what it looks like.
Sure, yeah, I love it. I love it.
Bulbous, terrified people pinpoints. It's horrible.
Yeah, the rest of the goblin masks, the actor's eyes get lost in the shadow of the mask.
Yeah.
This one fucking mask, your eyes are drawn to every time, and it just has bulging eyes, and of course, they don't move. They're just like stuck in this like manic expression and it sucks, basically. It just sucks.
This woman has already eaten the green stuff. So I knew that she wasn't long for this world. No. So I didn't really form any bond with her. Almond kind of chases after her. He doesn't believe the goblin thing. He tries to chat to them. He's like, let's just leave this lady alone.
That's his tactic.
How about that? He goes and walks up right next to them.
So Almond reassures his damsel in distress that he'll take care of it. He saunters up to the goblin gang and gives them a very stern talking to. And the rebuttal from the goblins is a spear that they launch into Almond's right shoulder.
Yep.
He screams, a scream overheard by his friends, who waste no time in doing absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
So Almond and the woman in white manage to get away. They find their way out of the forest and seek shelter in a large, nearby, red brick building. But the large room they find themselves in is incredibly odd, thick with fog and decorated with candles and old books, bottles of mysterious liquid, large pot plants, and in a far corner of the room, making a guest appearance in this film, it's the bed from Deathbed, the bed that eats.
It is.
Yep.
This room could have looked cool. Given that this room hosts my favorite performance of the film, I do wish that they'd shot it just slightly differently.
Sure.
Like these films, some of them could have been saved by just not showing everything at a wide angle.
Yeah.
Like if you just showed a few more details. But they really wanted us to see all of the effort that they put into making this room.
What kind of place is this? Almond asked rhetorically. This is my house, replies.
Oh my gosh,
Credence,
here she comes.
Leonor Gielgud.
This performance.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
This woman, mm-hmm. I don't really know what to compare her to, but she is great.
Yeah.
She puts every single muscle of her face into saying every single line. She puts her all into the performance in a way that some of the other actors don't.
Yeah, right.
And I love it. I just think it's great.
Yeah. The only choice that I'll criticize is the vaguely, ambiguously Transylvanian accent. She's like,
yeah, see,
rolling
you don't like
it. And all this stuff.
You don't like it. I think it's
I'm
fine.
Not here for
I think it works.
Because later in the film, when we get to the popcorn scene, she just has an American accent. And I just fuck with it more.
But that's because she's changed. She asked for the power of Stonehenge to put her makeup on for her and to give her a lower cut dress. And it worked.
Yeah, right. Credence Leonor Gielgud is the queen of the goblins and of ancient druid origins. And she looks great.
She does.
She has spray on gray hair dye and her teeth have been spottily stained black. She's wearing a long black dress, like fishnet gloves, big circular glasses, and copious like necklaces
She's
and bracelets
great.
And rings.
Picture a Professor Trelawney mixed with Bellatrix Lestrange.
So Credence Leonor Gielgud can clearly see that something is wrong with her two house guests, so she immediately fetches them each a large steamy mug of miraculous broth. These two idiots do in fact drink from the mugs of miraculous broth, and less than 2 seconds later, the woman drops the drink to the floor, spilling smoking emerald green liquid all over the floor. The same emerald green liquid that this woman is now puking everywhere. She clutches at her throat, seemingly struggling to breathe, stumbling into just everything.
It's just a long shot
of somebody just like intentionally stumbling into things.
There's no break for
it. She walks into every single prop en route to the staircase.
Screaming,
and she gets to the staircase that she manages to climb up with surprising ease for somebody who can barely breathe. Almond, however, can't move. He can't move a single muscle in his body.
He is not alarmed. He's not alarmed at all.
He's not alarmed at all. But he can move muscles in his face because he can still talk, but whatever, who cares? The woman conquers the staircase, but mere moments afterwards, she collapses to the floor, violently thrashing her limbs as the liquid pours more and more liberally down her entire body.
And here we get a very strange deathbed, the bed that eats scene.
Yeah, it's uncannily similar, actually. She becomes indistinguishable from the green goo, just a sloppy, oatmeal-y mess covering the floor. Half man, half plant, the goblin's favorite food. Credence Leonor Gielgud calls upon
Please
her-
just say it more and more ridiculously.
Credence Leonor Gielgud calls upon her horde of hungry goblins. They race towards the thick green mess, and they kneel down, and they scoop up this woman's remains with their makeshift goblin-y hands, and their feast begins. It's at this point that Almond delivers the film's most famous line. He's looking at the woman, and he screams, "They're eating her! And then they're going to eat me! Oh my God!"
I mean, if you got given that line, how on earth do you perform that well?
Yeah. You're right. I hadn't considered that because, as we learned from the documentary, these guys were not granted any artistic license with the dialogue. If it's written on paper,
oh,
you're
yeah,
saying
exactly.
It.
And if you get given those words, there's no way. There's no way no. you can perform that.
Next scene. Joshua doesn't like this place. Not one bit. End of scene. We did not need to see this. Not one bit. New scene. Holly, wearing a Garfield pajama shirt, rocks a cringy dance routine for an audience of her own reflection. So Holly pauses the music on her cassette player and she delivers a speech into the mirror. "Dear Elliot Cooper, tomorrow morning will be your final judgment. Either me or your boys. Take it or leave it. The beautiful Holly waits or your or your lovely little boys. Make a choice, Elliot."
Here's the thing. Usually I would be against this narrative. Like, yeah. We would all be against this narrative of like,
yeah.
Pick me or your friends. We would right. all usually be against that.
Yeah.
Except for in this sucks. Case where yeah. I get it. He's a fucking freak with his friends.
But at the end of Holly's speech, the lights begin to fade. Confusion floods her face. And Grandpa Seth's gigantic head is in the mirror. And he's calling out, "Joshua, Joshua." So Holly screams, obviously, and wakes up everybody for a group huddle in the hallway.
Oh, hang on, though.
Yeah.
She is yeah. vocally yep. performing panic
yes.
and screaming, but physically walking very calmly yeah, very, down the yeah. hallway.
She wakes up everybody, and Holly says that she saw Grandpa Seth and that he was looking for Joshua. And Joshua says, "See, it wasn't me this time." So the whole family goes into the bedroom. They inspect the mirror, but not a single grandpa to be found. Holly doesn't want to sleep in this room anymore, but Joshua totally does. So they swap rooms. So Joshua and Grandpa Seth catch up. No new information except that Nilbog is the land of the goblins, and y'all gotta peace the fuck out ASAP.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, Seth, to me, doesn't seem like a very comforting grandpa name.
Not really.
If you could go with any name, you've written a script and the grandpa's
Almond.
Supposed to be like Santa. Almond.
Yeah.
Grandpa Almond.
Lovable Grandpa Almond. So next scene, Elliot's yellow shirt wearing friend, Drew, stretches outside before running towards town. So next scene. So Joshua's mom and dad are appalled for some reason that the family that actually live in this house didn't buy them a month's supply of food.
I know.
How unreasonable is that?
They constantly complain about this.
So Joshua and his dad head into town to get groceries. Next scene. Drew is still running towards town when a local sheriff offers him a lift, and he gets in. The sheriff's name is Sheriff Gene Freak.
You can pick any name in the world.
So the sheriff's name is Sheriff Gene Freak, which is spelt exactly how it sounds. And he kindly offers Drew a sandwich, a green sandwich, which he eats.
It's not a sandwich. It's like a Burger King burger with green goo coming
yeah,
out.
Yeah, it's just a bun with green shit in the middle.
Yeah, and everyone's just fine to eat this
everyone's
stuff in
down.
This film.
Once they arrive at the general store, Drew steps out of the cop car, at which point he asks where all the girls from around here go at night.
Then Eugene Freak says,
"The girls!"
And then he drives away and he just
the
and
girls.
He's saying
it
this.
Is, yeah. So Drew looking visibly unwell after eating a sandwich where the main ingredient was a color, walks through a small crowd of judgy mans outside of the store. Yeah. He reaches the door and he steps inside. He sluggishly drifts towards the counter when a most peculiar man appears, a straw hat on his head, an untrustworthy smile, and a purposeful stare upon his face.
Yeah, this counter is definitely someone's kitchen.
Yeah, he's the drugstore owner, as he's simply referred to in the credits, and he asks, "Can I help you?" "Coffee," the boy replies. "There is no coffee here in Nilbog. It's the devil's drink." Drew sighs. "Eggs," he tries this time, which prompts the reaction of something along the lines of, "Ugh!"
Succinct. He gets his point across.
Drew tries bacon this time. "Are you crazy, boy? We're vegetarians here in Nilbog. Didn't you know that?"
Yeah, so this apparently this whole film is an effort to discredit vegetarianism.
Yeah.
Because all of her friends had recently become vegetarian. Yes. And it annoyed her.
Yeah, it's like anti-vegetarian propaganda. This woman was so irked that a couple of her friends went vegetarian at the same time that in her next film she was like, "I'm gonna write, instead of vampires, I'm going to make the monsters vegetarians." And that's what she did.
Yeah. You would think then that the film wouldn't center around eating people.
Well, you would think that. And you'd be right to
think
that.
Yeah, but then
that.
I guess there's no danger.
Right. Yeah. What's the catch in Twilight is that the vampires are vegetarians in the sense that they don't eat people. They do kill animals. That's the vegetarian equivalent of a vampire. These guys are vegetarians in that they don't eat animals. They eat people and plants. It's weird, but fuck it.
They eat people that have been
half
turned
man,
into plants.
Half plant, the goblin's favorite food. So what the drugstore owner does offer Drew is some Nilbog milk. Special milk. High in vitamin content. Here, it's free. Drew thanks the scary, scary man, and he leaves. But on his way out, the judgy mans, only this time, we notice that they all share the same splotchy, clover-shaped birthmark, just as the Presence family did. And they have a message for Drew. And the message is, Almond says meet him in the house that looks like an old church. So meanwhile, inside the house that looks like an old church, Credence Leonor Gielgud is watering a tree. But not just any old tree, it's a tree that's also Almond. And while she's watering Almond, she tells him that she's just prepared this pudding with wild nettles and a few organic additives to make it delicious and purify the intestines. So the Goblin Queen leaves the house to reveal Almond's face, which has been completely buried underneath like bark and branches and shit now. Okay, well, this next scene is just chaos. So I'm just going to like list off some bullet points and make everybody's life just a little bit easier. So Joshua and his dad arrive at the store. The store is closed for 20 minutes, though. Drugstore owner's at the sermon. Dad sits down and reads a vegetarian cookbook. Joshua walks back to the car. He looks for Grandpa Seth in the rearview mirror. He doesn't see him, but he does see a street sign. Nilbog. It's goblin spelled backwards. And this is their kingdom. He looks back at his dad. His dad fell asleep. And Joshua skateboards out of frame, slower than walking. End of scene.
The existence of a vegetarian cookbook in this universe suggests that they cook vegetables. In which case, why do they have to eat people that have been turned into vegetables?
It's their favorite food. Half man, half plant. The goblin's favorite food.
Yeah, but you don't have your favorite food every day. So lasagna might be your favorite food every day, but you don't have it every day.
I don't think these guys do have half man, half plant every day. I think they're excited that they have the opportunity to have some half man, half plant.
I see. Okay.
So next scene, Drew is stumbling and a-tumbling through the forest, drenched in his own sweat now. He takes a big swig of Nilbog milk and immediately spits out the entire mouthful, dropping the jug to the ground, and a white substance, the consistency of glue, is just like spilling out onto the forest floor.
It's so gross.
Ah! Joshua's mom is startled when she's tapped on the shoulder by her neighbor, Credence Leonor Gielgud.
This is so funny.
This is a
funny.
Weird scene.
No. This is the bit with the shot of the cake. So yeah, so she comes in. Credence Neil Book, whatever, comes in. She says, "Hi, I'm a neighbor, and like I've made you this cake. It's one of my ancient recipes." And then it cuts to the cake, and it's just a shitty sponge with the worst green icing that spells out welcome. Where they like even like ran out of room at the end of the cake, and it's like, ooh, ancient. It's like being like, "I want you to taste my 1,000-year-old cake recipe," and then it cuts to just like a Colin the Caterpillar cake or something.
Right. So Credence Leonore Gielgud, she taps Mrs. Waits on the shoulder, and she's surprised, which is fair. But she also doesn't react as if this woman isn't at all odd until she describes her daughter as appetizing and provocative.
Big gay vibes coming from the Goblin Queen.
So the Goblin Queen hands the woman the cake that we've described in great detail, and now the scene is just over and it's fine. Meanwhile, Joshua skateboards further and further away from his family members until he hears an organ droning from within a large white barn. He follows the sound and finds himself at a sermon, the sermon that caused the closure of the general store. Joshua attempts to eavesdrop, but he can't hear through the closed door, so he sneaks upstairs, rests his skateboard on the ground. That'll be important.
Very deliberately.
And
very
he finds
carefully.
A small hole in the floor through which he can look at and listen to the sermon. Leading the sermon is a guy named Bells.
He has a name?
His name is Bells.
Okay.
His name is never said.
He's quite well cast.
He's fun.
He has these kind of piercing
eyes.
Yeah,
I like it. I don't know why his name is just Bells, but fuck it. It's fine. And in attendance at the sermon, the Presence family. The family who are supposed to be staying in Joshua's house right this second.
Heck, yes.
So I copied and pasted the entire sermon, if you'd like me to read it.
No, you didn't.
"The lowest instincts are spreading in a horrifying way. All men, especially men from the cities, are letting themselves succumb to the vices of meat, the flesh, the decaying part of the body."
Hang on. So you and I are both vegan, right? Mm-hmm. And I can't say, from what I remember, that I necessarily disagree with what he's saying. I do think it's really weird and intense.
The decaying part of the body. It is so material and repulsive. Repulsive, symbol of original sin, which has consumed fall of the human race, which is so dear to us. Flesh, and by flesh I mean all that stinking, disgusting meat. Everyone goes, ugh. Hamburgers, ugh. Steaks, and the steak sausages, and hot dogs sold by the side of the road. The stink of smoked carcasses. Ugh. The humans nourish themselves with these, violating their own bodies, infecting themselves, creating uncurable ailments. Smelly bladders.
I don't know why.
Nests of infection.
That must be a translation issue.
Clusters of hemorrhoids.
Fucking
vicious
hell.
Stinking excrement. Vicious stinking. That's where it ends.
Yeah,
it's intense.
It's just like,
so it's at this point in the sermon that Joshua accidentally knocks into his skateboard, sending it crashing down to the ground floor, commanding the attention of every nil body in the sermon.
And then the most terrifying shot of the whole film.
Oh yeah,
happens.
Exactly.
It's actually
so
scary.
We see Josh, and then we see a hand reach through the ceiling, and it's squishing his little face. We cut to Holly. She's walking up to the Winnebago. She gives Elliot an ultimatum. Is it her or is it his lovely little boys? And when he doesn't choose, Holly punches him in the face.
Punches
End
him.
Of this scene.
Yeah, not cool.
Cut back to Joshua, now down on the ground floor of the barn and or church. And he's being restrained by Pastor Bells and Sheriff Freak.
Sheriff Freak.
And he's not even technically Pastor Bells. He's being restrained by Bells. And Sheriff Freak.
Freak.
It's just... Christ.
Gene
it's
Freak.
So weird. So the rest crowd around and close in on little Joshua as two locals prepare a bowl of creamy, delicious Nilbog ice cream. So everyone in the room in perfect unison chants, "Open your mouth, my little friend." while they tried to feed him ice cream.
It's not ice cream. It's just like milk.
No, yeah. So,
it's like green milk.
Yeah, they're trying to forcefully spoon green milk in the direction of Joshua's mouth. Joshua is screaming, "Help, Grandpa Seth! Help!" But Grandpa Seth is probably trapped in the wrong fucking mirror again because he doesn't show up and he doesn't help his grandson. But Joshua's dad, Michael, shows up and he wants to know what all these people are doing to his son. And
yeah, it looks real bad. Like, yeah.
But as always, he is so ready to believe them instead of his own kid because...
Yeah, because it's adults versus kids.
Because Joshua tears into how they're all goblins, monstrous beings, and they were only feeding him ice cream so they could eat him.
That line is so funny. He literally says, like, they're goblins, monstrous beings. And it's like, what 8-year-old speaks that way?
They were feeding him ice cream so they could eat him, and they all have a clover-shaped splotch, and Nilbog is just goblin spelt backwards. So you can't disagree with that, Michael. But it's just Joshua's usual bullshit, honestly. So it gets disregarded pretty quickly. But then Michael spots the Presents family, the family who are supposed to be staying in their home, and they're still here in Nilbog, which is goblin spelt backwards. Finally, yeah. Michael starts to suspect that his son might be onto something here, and the two back away and out of the door. At which point, Bells, the pastor, roars my favorite line in this movie, the incredibly vague words, "We need time for some things to happen." So Joshua and Michael are driving away when they see Holly, and she's locked in a screaming match with that playboy son of the Coopers. And Michael demands that they all get in the car right now. Everyone except Brent, because fuck Brent. This man has offered us absolutely nothing this entire film.
I've just realized we've forgotten something entirely.
What's that?
Going back to Holly seeing Grandpa Seth in her mirror, did you talk about her getting accused of doing weed?
I did not talk about that. Michael delivers the line like, it was probably just your imagination or a hallucination. Are you smoking dope again, Holly? At some point in the past, this family had to deal with Holly's dope dependency.
She got over it. She works out now.
Yeah, exactly. So Drew, physically exhausted and sweating green goo, finally arrives at the house that looks like a church. He's walked all this way to meet Almond, but Almond is nowhere to be seen. Nobody is. There's just a bed and that muffled screaming tree over there. Oh shit, that's just Almond. So Drew rips away the bark that covers Almond's face. And finally able to speak once more, Almond says, "Get me out of here, Drew. Just get me out of here."
Yeah.
And it's so funny
Almond
to me.
Almond is done with
it. It's so funny to me because he doesn't like scream. There's no desperation. He's just like fucking over it. And he just goes, "Just get me out of here."
And then Drew is doing his best. Yeah. Yellow shirt boy is pulling the whole weight of his friend as a tree.
In a plant pot.
In a plant pot. Across the floor. Yeah. Whilst sick.
Yes.
And Almond has the audacity to roll his eyes.
And I firmly believe that that's him breaking character. And he's just so over filming this scene. And they just caught it because it's so out of character. The only way it could be in character is that he just finds this situation so ridiculous that he can't help but roll his eyes. But I think it's just the actor and he's just sick of this movie. So Drew makes it all the way to the door, dragging his friend Almond, until he's too tired and he has no choice but to give up, which it transpires doesn't matter anyway, because the Goblin Queen is back, and her backhanded slap to Drew's face catapults him back across the room, and he lands on the large bed, and it's one of the only points where this bed matters in this film. She then turns to Almond. He needs to be punished, so she reaches for a nearby chainsaw and turns Almond into a milkshake.
That's the end of Almond.
Don't ask me how. Plant person plus chainsaw equals milkshake. This film has bigger problems than this, but I can't answer this for anybody. I don't know.
You believe it, because that's just the logic of this film, and that's fine.
So she takes a chainsaw to Almond, which doesn't hurt. It just tickles him, and he laughs a bunch, and this turns him into a milkshake. A milkshake that's prepared next to Drew, which is the last time we see him. He never comes back after this.
She just eats him. In which case, Elliot gives no shits that his friends die.
Right.
The boys, who he literally cannot be separated from.
They die. And then he goes home with the Waits family without the boys. He might not even check on the boys. He might think the boys are all fine, even though two of them have died. Joshua, his dad, his sister, and her boyfriend all arrive back at the Nilbog house to discover cars filling the driveway and upbeat country music coming from within the house. They walk inside, and the entire town of Nilbog is there, laughing, singing, and dancing from room to room. Diana, Joshua's mom, is thrilled to see her family. She tells them all about the surprise the town prepared for them, as well as the huge buffet of delicious green treats that occupy each and every table. Bells is here, too. And he explains to Michael that the surprise party is to apologize for the misunderstanding earlier today. And this explanation is everything that Michael needs to hear, and it completely dismantles Joshua's newfound credibility. Joshua tries to remind his family of morons that the goblins are still fucking goblins, but all this gets him is banished to his room.
They're about to eat the food. Yeah. And he's just like, fuck it.
Yeah, it's like, I get it. You're sick of trying to convince your family that these goblins are goblins. But if they eat the food, they die.
They die.
Let's try a little harder, guy.
You peed on their food last time to stop them from eating it. Why are you so fine with it happening now?
Joshua, back in his bedroom, gazes into the mirror. Grandpa! Grandpa Seth! He's calling out. Meanwhile, the Nilbogians are filling plates with local delicacies such as green cake and brown cake and white cake, and they're walking ominously in the direction of the Waits family and Elliot, because Elliot's part of the family now, and we're just fine with this, even though he's been like the most absent, neglectful boyfriend ever.
He wants to be around her. He just wants to be around her and his boys.
Elliot and his boys are part of the family now, Mom. She goes, oh, Elliot and the boys. Grandpa, Grandpa Seth, come quick, Joshua's still calling out. But that's no grandpa. That's a furious goblin queen.
Oh my gosh, that actually scared me.
Yeah, so she's in the mirror and she smashes it. And from it launches a goblin, coming straight for Joshua. The two are rolling and wrestling and rolling some more until Grandpa Seth appears, and he's got an axe, and he swings it down hard and slices through the goblin's wrist, separating his hand from his arm. Honestly, it makes more of like a bonk noise.
Yeah, it's not great.
The hand just sort of breaks off like it's made of like plaster.
Sure.
Or something.
Yeah.
It's like a dusty sort of disconnect from its wrist. So the goblin flees back through the window, piecing itself back together in like a reversed shot of it shattering. The goblin tumbles back into the house that looks like a church.
Yeah.
And it transforms back into the Goblin Queen. Her hand is missing.
This performance is amazing.
Yeah, it rocks.
She is shrieking.
Yeah, it's fun. I like it.
And then she plunges her hand into the Stonehenge portal that she seems to have in her house.
The Stonehenge portal is like a crack in the wall, and pouring out of it is like bright white light and dry ice. She slips her wound into the crack in the wall. When she pulls it out, she has a hand again. Joshua and Grandpa Seth share a smile, which is always a fun moment, and they quickly devise a plan to put out the fire. What fire? The fire they're about to start with this Molotov cocktail that Grandpa Seth is now holding.
Oh my gosh.
Like, he escalates
the
situation severely.
Grandpa's like, the only way to save them is for them all to die.
in a house fire. So I guess their plan is to set the house on fire with the family still inside and the goblins, but I don't know. Not sure what it's going to achieve, but what happens by complete accident ends up being the better plan. So they're lighting the Molotov cocktail when Bells snatches the bomb from their hands. Then he takes shit to a whole nother level and banishes Grandpa Seth back to hell. But not before Grandpa Seth casts some evil underworldly spell and strikes the bomb in the pastor's hand with a bolt of lightning, and Bells is set alight, his hands above his head, burning alive. The entire party overhear the commotion outside, so they run outside, and Michael douses the flames with a nearby fire extinguisher. This is a fire extinguisher that Grandpa Seth is holding. Says a line to the effect of, "You burn down the house, I'll distract them with this fire extinguisher." But when the smoke subsides, they see not the body of the pastor, not even the body of a human, but the body of a goblin.
And then all the goblins have kind of gathered around and they turn on all the humans, right?
Yeah, yeah. Nilbog stopped playing nice right about now. So the family killed one of their kind, and now it's their turn to kill this family. The Waits family plus Elliot run back inside, unchallenged. They just run inside, and it's easy and fine. So now Credence Leonore Gielgud is pissed as all hell, and with her brand new hand, she commands the greatest power her Druidian gods or ancestors can summon, and they grant her the power of lipstick and boobs. Meanwhile, Brent's just back at the RV, blissfully unaware of the wild-ass night that's befallen Nilbog. He's scanning through the TV stations when he hears a sexy little song, and he sees a woman in black making her way through a forest, slinking up towards the screen. It's the Goblin Queen, and in her hands, a raw ear of corn. "Do you like it?" she asks. "Shall we eat it together?" "What kind of show is this?" Brent asks the TV. "I'm not a program," she replies. "I'm real. Come outside and you'll see." And he does. And there she is. And he invites her inside. And thus begins one of the oddest romantic moments in the history of cinema.
Oh, it's bizarre.
So she pushes Brent down onto the bed, and she just starts caressing this raw ear of corn.
First of all, like, it's sort of sexy towards him, and then she completely misreads any sexual situation and starts caressing the right. corn as if that's what people want to see, as if that's what he wants to see. And then gets very confused, and she's like, don't you like corn or something like that? And he's like, "I like popcorn." Mm-hmm.
To which she replies, "No problem. All we have to do is heat it up." And then the music gets sexy again. And now the two are horizontal and are eating from the same ear of corn. No hands, just making out through
it's
opposite
really gross.
Ends
like,
of the
this
corn.
This must have sucked to
film. Oh, fuck this. Yeah, that would be disgusting. They're making out on their respective ends of this corn on the cob when popcorn just begins to burst and fire all around these guys like buttery confetti. It's just everywhere. And you see later that Brent's got it like in his ears and up his nose. It must have been a nightmare to film. Meanwhile, the Waits family, joined by Elliot, reach out to Grandpa Seth via a seance. And when it eventually works, all the candles get blown out and a blinding white light silhouettes the family. Joshua is told by his grandpa that he only has 10 minutes to destroy the magic stone that give power to the goblins.
The mother's reaction to the seance is the only normal reaction that she's had.
Right.
Her reactions are usually at an emotional range of like 10 out of 10. Right. And this is the only time where that's appropriate.
Yes.
Where her dead father is speaking to her from beyond the grave. She goes, "Dad." Yeah. But with the level of intensity that she's delivered every other line, including "sing me that song I like."
Yeah, right. Yeah. Singing "Row, row, row your boat" with the intensity of "that's the voice of my dead dad." So like I said, Grandpa Seth says they only have 10 minutes until it's 6 p.m. and he disappears forever. And then we cut to a clock that shows that it's 5 to 6 and that they only have 5 minutes, I guess. Or maybe the clock's set wrong. I don't know.
Maybe he didn't teleport. Maybe he walked. Maybe Grandpa Seth's not as magical as he thinks he is.
I love it so much. When his grandpa's voice disappears, so too does Joshua. And his family are alone in the Nilbog home when it's stormed by a stampede of goblins. There's like a dozen of these guys.
Yeah.
And they are pissed. Joshua wakes up. He's in the house that looks like a church. Joshua gets chased by a goblin now too. Grandpa Seth saves the day yet again. And he like sucker punches this goblin and it does a full 360. Grandpa Seth hands Joshua some super secret weapon in a backpack. And the two place their palms on the ancient Stonehenge wall, which I guess wastes the Goblin Queen because she's shrieking again. Over by the Winnebago now. They're placing their palms on the Stonehenge wall, which causes the Goblin Queen to shriek, which causes the goblins to just sort of disappear in a flash from within the Nilbog home. And now the family are safe.
Wait, we did miss out on the great goblin chase through the Nilbog home.
Take us there.
All of the family, bar Joshua, obviously, are being chased through the upstairs one hallway that they have several times somehow. Yeah. Goblins leaping out left, right, and center, and Dad attacks them, and Elliot gets attacked, and Holly gets pinned to the wall, and it's all fine. They throw the same goblin down the stairs, I think, twice. It's all very dramatic.
And I'm glad you brought it up, because otherwise I would have forgotten to mention one of my favorite lines, which is when Elliot tries to reason with the goblins, saying something to the effect of, "We're all humans."
It's just the only thing that's not
no,
true.
You're not. It's the only, it's the only incorrect thing you can say in this moment. So now Grandpa Seth disappears for good this time. The Goblin Queen and her gang are back and they corner Joshua and they're finally going to get to eat this kid.
Yeah.
They've been trying this entire film until he reaches into the backpack that Grandpa Seth just gave to him. And he heroically lifts out the only secret weapon that can defeat the goblins once and for all, which is
a bologna sandwich.
A double-decker bologna sandwich. Gasp, disgust, other emotions. The Goblin Queen is going like, don't do it. Think about the fat in your blood. Think about the cholesterol. Think about the toxins.
This writer's friends must have sucked. They must have been the worst kind of vegetarians.
Oh, yeah, the most self-righteous, preachy vegetarians ever.
Or, I mean, she might just have a lot of...
She's just projecting. Joshua wolfs down the sandwich, and he runs back towards the wall, and he reapplies his palms as he continues to chew the sandwich of justice. And his family arrive just in time, and they all put their hands on the stone and they concentrate and they concentrate harder and they concentrate even harder. And then the Goblin Queen and all of her little goblin pals explode and bleed and melt, and some of their eyes explode and one falls off of a banister. And
one of their eyes explode because it's the only one that has eyes.
Exactly.
So the one that we've been looking at this whole time.
Exactly.
His eye explodes and then it does it again in another shot. You just reuse it from a different angle.
And they did it. And they conquered the goblins once and for all.
Goblin Queen's death is amazing.
It's fun, man. I'm here
for
it.
Her performance is just so good. It never falters in this whole film.
Round of applause, standing ovation. Deborah Reed crushing it.
My favorite performance of the film by far.
And they did it. They did it. They conquered the goblins once and for all. Except they didn't, because they go home and Joshua's mom gets eaten by goblins anyway. The end.
So they get home. They all drive back in their car. They sit in the driveway. Dad immediately just goes, "I got to swing by the office." And it's like, that's not what you do, man. After you've almost been eaten by goblins, you come back from a family holiday and the same afternoon you go into the office.
They narrowly survive being eaten by goblins, and everybody comes home with this like awkward ass energy.
Elliot has a fairly good reaction.
Yeah.
Elliot's like, "I think I'm gonna go home for a while," and that's fair.
Yeah.
And then Holly is like, "Yeah, I'm coming with you." So they go together.
I wish instead of Elliot being like, "I'm gonna go home," he goes like, "I'm gonna go check on the boys."
I wish.
"I'm gonna go check on the boys. I'm heading back to Nilbog, making sure the boys are okay."
Elliot's lost the most out of this whole
situation. Yeah, he's lost his three. He's lost at least two friends. Oh, Holly's stoked. Fuck the boys.
Dad goes, Elliot goes, Holly goes. It's just Mom and Joshua. Mom immediately goes into the fridge.
Tears into an apple.
Takes out a bowl of apples.
Yeah.
Yeah, she just tears into an apple. Joshua says he's going to go take a nap. So he goes upstairs. He tries to talk to his grandpa.
Yep.
But before he goes upstairs, Mom says, "I'm going to go take a shower."
Yep.
We're upstairs with Joshua in his bedroom.
Yep.
He says goodbye to his grandpa in his head. You know, grandpa's not actually there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
He hears like voices or something. And then he turns around and a baseball bounces down the steps and it's got the green icing on and it says, "Mom tasted good," or something like that. Something kind of weird. Then he goes into the shower pile of green goo. Mum's been killed. Yep. Very, very sad. Yes. Home Alone style scream face freeze frame. End of film.
Yeah. And that's Troll 2. So it is undeniably, indisputably a bad movie.
But it's the best bad
movie. And that's why the documentary is called Best Worst Movie. It might be impossible to not enjoy this movie. You could show this film to any person of any age, regardless of the language they speak. I just think everybody is going to enjoy this film.
But I think the important distinction is between the worst film ever and the best worst film. And this is the best one. This is the one that you actually want to watch because it's engaging, but it's still terrible.
Absolutely. The thing this film has is unadulterated sincerity and authenticity. It is so real. And the fact is, 20 years later, the vast majority of the cast, the actors, they regret or hate or laugh at this film. The director and the writer stand by this film and they believe it is a work of genius. And 20 years ago, everybody working on this project gave it everything they had and they believed in it and they wanted it to be a great film. And it just isn't. It is so awful.
And it's down to things that weren't necessarily in the actor's control, which is a shame.
Yeah.
Some things were in the actor's control.
Yeah,
it's just a good film. It's just fun.
So not only was that Troll 2, but that was the podcast.
That was the podcast.
It's been more work than I think either of us had imagined.
We haven't slept for a few days now, but I think that makes some of these films more enjoyable.
Yeah. And like I say at the start of these podcasts, stay inside, look after yourselves, and please, if you can, vote.
Vote.
Have a great Halloween, everybody. We love you so much.
We love you.
Stay safe.
Stay safe.
It's over!
It's over!